Today's Teisho will be on Case 41 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, Bodhidharma's Mind Pacifying. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second founder stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind." "Bring your mind here and I will pacify it for you," replied Bodhidharma. "I've searched for my mind and I cannot take hold of it," said the second patriarch. "Your mind is now pacified," said Bodhidharma. Mumon's comment, the broken-toothed old Hindu, came so importantly thousands of miles over the sea. This was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Why, Shisanro did not know four ideographs. Mumon's verse, "Coming east, directly pointing, you entrusted the Dharma and trouble arose. The clamor of the monasteries is all because of you." This is the fifth day of our October session. And once again, everybody did a wonderful job this morning. And indeed, I have to tell you the truth that last night was, we're just generally speaking, today has been a wonderful day, but yesterday was like, I shouldn't put it this way, but yesterday was like the perfect day, right? Because basically everybody was sitting, you know, diligently, and people were coming into Dokusan, and you know, it was just, everything was working. It was just great, you know. And you know, people were coming into Dokusan, and it was so clear. People, you know, everybody was doing such a great job. I was just walking on air, you know. I just, at the end of the day, I just felt like, I don't smoke cigars, but I felt like I should just have a big cigar. It was just great. Things have gone so well. People have felt so deeply. And the practice here has been such excellent practice. It's just really, really. I would have lit a big cigar, put my feet up on the desk. You know, it's a job well done. So to you I say, job well done. Very good. So, you know, we still have a number of sits. So keep practicing with this excellent commitment, this open-heartedness, you know. So today's Teisho involves a famous story. Dhammo, Bodhidharma, was a Buddhist monk from India. Probably, some people say he was from South India, from the Tamil Nadu, and some people say he was from Kashmir. So we really don't know. But he was very adept in a particular school of Buddhism that became Chan, or Zen. And Bodhidharma was not a young man. He was about my age, actually, when he went to China from India. So he was highly respected. He had it made in the shade, you know. There was no particular reason to go anywhere. He could have stayed in India and been respected. But he decided to go to what was then this very alien place, China. And he went to China, and basically his reputation preceded him. was presented to the emperor, Emperor Wu of Liang, and in India he had a great reputation as a really adept, deeply awakened person. And so the emperor was a Buddhist at this time, and he was very, very interested in helping Buddhism to take root in his country. He was a very good man, and he was already surrounded by Buddhists of various schools who were all basically trying to get on his good side, you know what I mean? Some of them were opportunists who wanted to build big temples so they could have their names carved in stone. And some of them were really good people, good men and women who had the noble aims. It's a mix, as in any human community. And the emperor was sincere. He built monasteries and nunneries and libraries and so on. Anyway, Bodhidharma came to meet him, and it was the history of Zen starts with an unsuccessful job interview. Yeah? And I think that's just perfect. It's perfect. Right? So Bodhidharma goes to meet the emperor, and what was supposed to happen was this, you know. Bodhidharma goes to meet the emperor. The emperor meets Bodhidharma and says, "My God, you're deeply awake. You know, here I've got the plans in the drawer for your temple. You know, and you'll have 1,000 students in no time, and government stipend, and we'll give you some things to put on your robe, some ribbons or something. You'll be a national teacher. You know, and none of this happens, right?" He goes to meet the emperor, and this is a wonderful story, you know, because there's good intentions on both sides, see, but there's mutual misunderstanding. So Bodhidharma comes to meet the emperor, and the emperor says, "I have built, it's so great to meet you, Bodhidharma, Bhante, you know. Bhikkhu Bodhidharma, it's so great to meet you. I've heard such wonderful things about you. You know, I'm very interested in karma, in the laws of cause and effect. And I've been building temples all over China, and nuns and monks live there and practice the way from dawn till dusk with great diligence and study scriptures, study sutras. How far will that go in clearing away my negative karma? How much merit have I earned?" Now Bodhidharma is not trying to knock the guy's hat off his head. You know, he's not trying to, you know, give this guy a hard time or embarrass him or, you know, basically, humiliate him. He says, you know, actually, there is no merit. There's no merit. There's actually no such thing as merit. And the emperor's shocked. And he says, "Who are you?" And Bodhidharma says, basically, "Mu." He says, "Wu." He says, "Shunyata." And the emperor just thinks, "What the hell?" You know? And then he said, "Well, you know, I don't. Thanks, you know, thanks for coming. You know. Keep in touch. You know, we'll do lunch sometime, right? We'll do lunch sometime." And Bodhidharma leaves. And according to the story, there was at the court another Indian monk who was deeply awake and. And the emperor went to see him and said, "This guy named Bodhidharma came, and here's what he said to me." And he said, "What do you make of that guy?" And the guy said, the monk said, "He was the embodiment of loving kindness, of compassion." And the emperor goes, "Oh, crap, you know. Maybe I can get him before he gets away, you know." But it was too late. He'd already left, see? And so he went up to the area near what is now a Shaolin temple. And he lived in a cave for 9 years. Now, you know, I've talked about this before, but if Bodhidharma were an American, right, he'd issue a bunch of CDs, right? You'd have pictures of Bodhidharma with his arms in the air and a big smile on his face, right? He'd have, and it would be like, you know, his arms would be over his head like this, you know, he'd be looking with a big smile on his face, right? And there'd be a marketing thing, and you'd get these brochures in the mail, and it would go, Bodhidharma's, you know, life-transforming teachings, you know, yours for $9.95, you know, and he put out a book, you know, called, 10 Steps to a Better Life, right? And basically, he'd, you know, go around and, he'd be on TV, and they'd go, well, tell us, Mr. Dharma, you know, can I do it too? And sure, you know, of course, anybody can, you know, so on. But it didn't do that. He went up and he sat in a cave for 9 years, just facing. In the story, it said he practiced piquan, staring at the wall, at a wall in the cave. But we who practice the way know that it wasn't the wall in the cave he was staring at; it was the wall in our hearts. Yes, that we call mu. So he sat facing the wall for 9 years, purifying his body, heart, and mind by sitting face to face with emptiness. And lo and behold, people showed up. The right people showed up. They just came. He's a million miles away from anything. This was not the famous martial arts temple that it is today, where busloads of people go, and almost no meditation is practiced, I'm sorry to say. But he was in a cave, and local people thought he might be a spirit or a Taoist sage, so they would bring him things to eat so he didn't starve to death. One day, a guy shows up. This the second founder of Zen, okay, who is called Eka in Japanese. A woman shows up, and another guy later on. So Bodhidharma had three students who were his, who carried Zen into China. And all the temples in the world that are Zen temples come out of Bodhidharma and those three, the two men and the one woman. This is the story of his encounter with his first student. Okay, so Bodhidharma sat facing the wall for 9 years. But the Eka shows up, and Eka was an interesting guy. You know, he was a very well-educated Chinese person who had studied the Confucian classics and the Taoist literature, and he was unhappy with the sort of like cutting-edge knowledge of his society. And he was like a PhD in something, equivalent. Anyway, PhD in Confucian studies, which would have been like particle physics today, you know, very Confucius, that's very impressive, you know, make way for the scholar, you know. So he had done all that, he had been there and he'd done that, he wasn't satisfied. There's nothing wrong with studying Confucius, of course, or studying anything, very important, wonderful. But there was something missing in it for him, so he also needed something that he couldn't find. He heard about this guy living in a cave, and he thought, you know, well, it's, you know, I haven't found anything else, but I'll go, it's worth a trip up there. And when he saw Bodhidharma, he was deeply moved even before he knew anything about him, just by the fact that this guy's living in a cave practicing meditation. And he became tremendously excited, you know. And actually that sounds like a fairy tale, but you know, when I first met Genki Roshi, I actually got like excited. I mean, I couldn't sleep. I just really had to, you know, had to do this. So anyway, Eka, you know, really had, he realized, I really have to do this. You know, I have this burning desire to do this. And Bodhidharma, you know, has been waiting for students to show up for, you know, who knows how many years, and somebody finally shows up, and you know, you think he'd come out and go, thank God, you know, you're here, I've been waiting. It doesn't even come out, right? Then he goes, go away, you know. Go away, you're not serious, you know. So the guy stands in the snow all night, and Bodhidharma's in there sitting, and Eka's sitting in the snow. And Bodhidharma doesn't say, come on in, you know. Finally, Eka in the story, right, in the classical story, he says he cuts off his arm. This is there's a lot of pictures of this, of Eka standing in the snow with his arm in his other hand. And this is the story as presented in the Mumonkan. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. I don't like the word patriarch. Okay. Founder. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, my mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind. And Bodhidharma says, bring your mind here and I'll pacify it for you. Right? And then Eka says, I can't find it. And he says, your mind is now pacified, says Bodhidharma. Now that's the story in the Mumonkan, but it's like there's another version of this story which is better, and it has the punchline is missing from this version, but the punchline is this. After Eka cuts off his arm, Bodhidharma says, you didn't have to cut off your arm. Great, right? Now he tells me. You didn't have to cut off your arm. He said, I just wanted to find someone who didn't look to others for approval. I just wanted to find someone who didn't look to others for approval. That is so important, right? That's so important. See, Bodhidharma was someone who didn't look to others for approval. Bodhidharma was a very distinguished meditation teacher, and in either Tamil Nadu or beautiful Kashmir, right? And everybody saw him and said, oh, it's the great master, the great guru. And he goes to China where nobody's ever heard of him. And basically goes to meet the emperor. And, you know, he doesn't get down in the dumps when the interview doesn't go right. He has to go, oh gosh, oh, I knew it wouldn't turn out, you know, I'm no good, you know. And the interesting thing is when he meets the emperor, he doesn't like kiss his ass, you know. He's just totally forthright, and he's not contemptuous, but he's just totally honest and forthright. You know, because he gets his instructions from a different place. See, I mean, he's not looking for the emperor's approval. And this is so important, right? Because the emperor is the most powerful figure in China. He's the father, in the Chinese way, traditional Chinese way of thinking, he's like the father of the country. And yet Bodhidharma has is just treats him like another human being, another person who deserves compassion. And his motive isn't to be liked, to be thought well of, to be admired, to be salaried. You know, his motive is just to help. And when it doesn't connect, he doesn't get upset. He goes up to this cave and sits in the cave. This is so important. You know, people have an unrealistic understanding of their own psychology. You know, one of the things that's struck me as quite interesting about humans is that, you know, we have the longest period of immaturity of any creature that I know of on Earth. No, but this is a biological fact, right? I mean, basically, I think like in the case of like chimps, it's like, you know, a couple of years, 3-4 years, something like that. Lions, it's a year or two. You know, birds, it's like a season. But humans can't function on their own until they're quite far advanced physically. And they have to go through a long period of dependency, right? If you're in graduate school, you know the dependency goes on for, you know, till you're 40 almost, right? You know? And some people, you know, never become mature, you know, actually, and they can sometimes become very powerful. And they can become Emperor of the United States. But we have a long period of immaturity and a long period of dependence on powerful adults. People don't pay enough attention to this fact that it has an enormous impact on how humans live their lives. Because I think we're always looking, sort of like the theme of this sesshin, we're always looking for ratification from others. You know, we're always looking to please those giant, you know, when we're little kids, we're so helpless. And that too is rather unique, you know, in the animal kingdom, to have creatures who are so helpless for so long. And, you know, these giants that protect us, we look up to the giants, you know. And of course, when we're adults too, we treat powerful people, we're like little babies and they're the giants, you know. And we have this kind of dependency mentality. And now, I'm not knocking it. We couldn't be here if this weren't true. But it makes us sometimes be very false people. You know, lead very false lives. It becomes very difficult to tell the truth to ourselves about anything. You know, and so. You know, Zen practice is really about telling the truth about what is actually the case. You know, when the Buddha had his great awakening experience, you know, he didn't say, "Oh my gosh, it's like 1,000 angels singing hallelujah." You know, he doesn't. If you read the Gita, you know, when Arjuna has his great glimpse of divinity. It's this huge production, right? You know, it's like a Bollywood production. It's this huge production. Oh my God, there's armies and planets and oh my God, and it's on and on, you know. We read in Western literature too, you know, the angels are circling God and they're all singing hallelujahs and blah, blah, blah. And When the Buddha had his enlightenment, he in the sutras, he describes his enlightenment experiences on a number of occasions. And different sutras record different aspects of enlightenment. But very typically, the Buddha says, when the Buddha achieved his awakening, he saw what was the case and what was not the case. See, I could tell what was real from what wasn't real. See, it's not a very grand claim, right? But at least it doesn't seem so. But to be able to see what is right in front of us is so difficult, because we have all of these voices in our head telling us what we should see and what we should experience, right? And Zen practice is a process of like deconditioning. It's like radical deconditioning. So, you know, first of all, you've got to get, you've got to have a stabilized body-mind complex, right? So we sit on the cushion, we learn how to stabilize the body. Now when you're in meditation, you're balanced on the cushion, your heart rate is regular, boom, 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 you know. Your pulse, everything's very stable. Pulse drops, you know. Actually, you have a lower heart rate. And then, you know, mind, you teach the mind how to be calm. And it's very, very difficult for us to free ourselves from all of these scripts, all of this conditioning, right? You know, you sit on the cushion, and it's almost like solid conditioning, right? It's just like all this stuff is flowing through your head all the time. And our culture produces this, right? I mean, advertising is a good example, but so much of culture is like advertising, right? It's just an attempt to get you to think a certain way and worry about a certain set of beliefs, right? So, you know, when we sit on the cushion day one of Sesshin, it's like, oh my God, you know, I've got to get that report into my boss. If I don't get it in, he's going to think I'm a schlub, why did he say that to me, or blah, 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 blah. I can't tolerate this, you know. That means I'm no good. That means I'm nobody, you know. And if I'm nobody, that's terrible, you know. So we have all of these anxieties and all, you know. So day two of Sesshin, your mind starts to break free from this. And you begin to enter this state of calm, clear attentiveness. And it may not be continuous, but, you know, every once in a while it becomes possible to just be present in the moment without narrating it. Using the lessons you've been given by these powerful authorities. And you can just be in the moment. And this is enormously important. You know, lots of people have talked about this. You know, come into Dokusan and say, you know, today I had this experience. A cloudy sky, suddenly the clouds breaking apart, and it was just like I could see the clear sky. You know, it's that moment where all of this stuff, all of this cultural baggage, all of the conditioning, all of the lessons roll away, and we can just be in the moment. You know, to a certain kind of person, that sounds totally trivial. You mean that's all the Buddha had to teach? You know, I can see what is the case and what is not the case. You know, obviously there's nothing in Buddhism. You know, what about eternal life? What about blah, blah, blah? What about blah, blah, blah? But actually, much of what humans worry about is pure fantasy and utter, if I may say, utter bullshit. You know? Really and truly, it is. Or it's truth mixed in sort of fatally with all kinds of illusions. So for example, I grew up in a time when when I was a little boy, the Soviet Union and the United States were about to go to war, And in our school, we would all get up and we'd have a nuclear attack drill. Right? I'm sure you've heard of these. You know, we'd be marched out into the hallway, and we were told, you know, now crouch down. And so you get down in a squat, and you get down on on your knees on the ground, and then you were supposed to crouch down so that your bottom was touching your heels, and you'd put your head on the floor and you'd cover your head with your hands. It's like, that isn't really going to help. Right? But this was so we'd be easy to clean up, I think. You know? And my mother and father, I remember them planning a contingency, a route, an escape route from Baltimore, where my father was stationed, to upstate New York, where my mother's family is from. And the idea was that once nuclear war was declared, Dad would be, of course, on the ship. And Mom would get in the car, and we'd hit the, interstate, as if nobody else would be on the interstate. And we'd drive up to upstate New York, right? A brilliant plan. Right? So everybody thought that way. People had bomb shelters in their backyard. In fact, it was patriotic to build bomb shelters in your backyard. And there were pictures, like in Life magazine, of, it would show a guy with a pipe in his mouth. And he'd go into the bomb shelter, the nuclear, and there would be a little pipe coming out of the ground. It would be down in the ground. It would be made of cinder blocks. There would be a little vent pipe coming out. And there was like cans of stuff down there, and some magazines, and some cots, insane, right? I mean, and everybody from the president on down, totally bought into this. And this is an example. I mean, nobody at that time thought this was crazy. Nobody. Or very few people. Nobody said, this is fundamentally insane. I don't think you can trust culture. Automatically. It has many good things, right? I mean, the arts are wonderful, science is wonderful, politics is wonderful, but it's all mixed in with a huge amount of insanity, really. There's nothing really mystical about what we're doing. It's deconditioning the mind, teaching the mind to be in the moment, without relying on all of these scripts. And it's very, very difficult for humans to do, but that moment, it may just be once during a session where you're just in the moment without evaluation or judgment, right? And all of a sudden, the pure presence of the moment is here, and I just think this is the most beautiful experience. And if you keep coming back to moments like that, it really does change you. You become, it sounds like a cliche, but you become grounded. You have a kind of ability to be truthful to yourself and to others. And we all have a capacity for self-deceit, infinite capacity. That's how we get to, the bomb shelters in the backyard. But there is a way. I think it's so crucial. You sit on the cushion for 5 days, the mind becomes calm. We all deeply neurotic, But you sit on the cushion, and little by little, these neurotic compulsions begin to move aside. And you begin to have these moments of pure presence. And if you stay there long enough, it changes you. We have a, there's this word, the man of Zen or the woman of Zen. A person who it's just like Bodhidharma said. You don't have to cut off your arm, but I'm looking for someone who does. I want to find someone who doesn't look to others for approval. Look to the real. Look to what's real. And now, for many people, reality would not sound very interesting, but people don't even know what reality is. I mean, believe it or not, I swear to you, Mu is real. It's real. It's real. People don't notice it because they're hysterical, right? I mean, people are confused ordinarily by all these different messages and all these anxieties and all these neurotic compulsions that it's very hard for them to notice what reality is. So Zen practice is developing a stable mind, a calm mind, and a capacity to observe with great precision and without illusion. And you begin to notice all kinds of strange things, like when you listen to a sound, your mind goes blank. Now, why is that? Nobody told me about that, you know. It's very important. At any rate, this is one way to think about Zen practice, you know. Deepening your life by finding your, we say in Zen, your true nature. True nature is the life you live when you are in the real. When you're in those moments where we get through all of our neurotic compulsions, all of our wishful thinking and fantasies, and suddenly the clouds part and it's like an open sky. And people are so terrified of that. They think, well, they think that would be a disaster. Well, then, what are my beautiful illusions? They're all gone. But actually, when that happens, you know, everything becomes part of yourself. You know, everything becomes part of yourself. You know, there's a person in our group who came into Dokusan and said, you know, and this person's been practicing for quite a long time. And the person said, you know, I have these experiences where the other day I got on a bus and I looked at the face of this old woman and I just felt like, I felt totally like this is me, you know, this thing. And of course, if you do Zen long enough, you have these experiences all the time because indeed it is you. You know, so the world is very different from what people believe, you know. If you're on the path of Zen, as I said a few days ago, it's not everybody's path, you know. And people who don't do Zen can be wonderful people, you know. But if Zen is your path, you know, it's really quite unique. And I know everybody here has had some of these moments where, you know, the world as it actually is so much better than anything we can imagine. It's so much richer and more alive and more beautiful than anything we can cook up, you know. And this is why I think Zen is so exciting, you know, so energizing. A number of people came in and just said, I have so much energy. I feel so, you know, alive. And it's getting in contact with the world as it really is, which is our, you know, really truly our true home. So you don't have to. So the point is, you don't have to cut off your arm, but you know, you have to. It does take a kind of fearlessness to live this way. Basically, I have to tell you the truth. Fear has always been one of my biggest problems, you know. I'm a very fearful person. I think there's complicated reasons that I won't bore you with. But I will tell you one quick story, because I'm not running out of time. You know, when my father was stationed at Baltimore, we lived in one tough neighborhood, man. It was tough. And if I could get to school and get home without getting in a fight, which I usually lost, right? You know, it was like a great day, right? You know. So I was, you know, like, I learned early on to, like, I got to be tall, but I wasn't tall when I was, like, you know, first grade. And I lived in fear for years, you know, really. And I think it really left a deep mark on my personality, you know. Because I can even now remember, you know, just sort of thinking, okay, I'll take this street, you know, I know they're not waiting for me there, you know. Really, it was like that. It was like living in a jungle, right, you know. If I go to the back, there was a bird sanctuary, and I had two friends, and we were all, you know, kids, and we were also like wimps, you know. So we wanted to get home without getting in a fight, you know, and we didn't want to beat anybody up, and we didn't want to be beaten up. So there was a bird sanctuary between the school and our apartment complex, so we could go through the bird sanctuary. Maybe that's how I learned to like nature. It was the place where I didn't get beaten up, you know. But it left a mark. And fearfulness is very much in my personality, you know. So a lot of my Zen practice was working through various kinds of fears, you know. And I was even afraid of doing Zen, you know. Because, you know, when I started doing Zen, I thought, you know, I was afraid that, first of all, I was afraid that basically I was wasting my time because my brother was making a lot of money and I wasn't making any money, you know. and I felt like a bum, you know. And so one of the reasons I went to graduate school was just so I could, you know, sort of wouldn't feel so inconsequential. But when I got to graduate school, that was like terrifying, right? Because it was a very competitive, and so that was terrifying. And then when I got involved in Zen, I was afraid that I was going to be a failure at Zen, you know? So it was like fear, 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 fear. And I just threw myself into Mu, because every once in a while, the fear would go away, and it felt so great. It felt, being free from my fear felt better. It was more positive than the pain in my legs was negative, you know? On balance, I had a lot of pain in my legs, but the sweet feeling of that freedom, to live in fear and just have it go away is worth almost any price. I think you would agree. And so, you know, this is a small price to pay for the beautiful, beautiful freedom we experience. I think. Anyway. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, saying, "My mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind." See, so he's got an understanding of his problem, which is based upon what he's read in his books, right? And Bodhidharma says, "Well, bring your mind here, mind, okay? Bring your mind here, and I'll pacify it." So this is Zen, right? He says, he doesn't say, "Let me read you a sutra," you know. He says, "Okay, your mind's on fire with anxiety. I want you to sit down and try to find your mind. Just sit down calmly, watch your breath, and tell me about your mind." And so Eka sits down, and he sits there, and he's, you know, "My mind's filled with it's on fire, you know? Fine, show me your mind." And he's trying to find the mind using the method we use here, you know, Zazen, and can't find it. Yeah, my God, there is no mind. There is no, and indeed there is no mind, actually. And he comes back to Bodhidharma and says, "Well, who'd have thought, you know? Who'd have thunk, right? There's no mind." And Bodhidharma says, "Well, not bad, huh? You know? Feeling better?" And then Eka says, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, I do feel better." So what is actually, what you think is that, you know, poor Eka is chased around by his illusions. Even his understanding of his problem is an illusion. And Bodhidharma says, "Let's just look at what's actually the case. Go ahead, show me this mind. Where is it?" And the more Eka, if Eka were not the person he was, this wouldn't have worked out. But he was somebody who had great determination and mental stability, and he practiced right then and there, and could see that he was, that the reality was not what he thought. So this is like the basic method of Zen in this little koan. So now your mind is pacified. If you just take away the illusions, just take away illusions, and reality is there. And just take away, you just get rid of your illusions, and that's all you have to do. So all we have to do is sweep, sweep, sweep. Use our breath to sweep away this, sweep away that. Use your mood to cut, cut, cut. Every time an idea arises, you cut, cut, cut. Just cut away those illusions, cut away those scripts, those lessons, all that belonging, and boom, it's heaven, heaven on earth. Okay, Mumon's comment, that broken-toothed old Hindu came so importantly, thousands of miles over the sea. Remember, in Zen, this is a compliment, right? Okay, that broken-toothed old Hindu means, thank God he came, right? And he says, this was raising waves where there was no wind. In other words, making a big fuss over nothing, right? And indeed, in his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. In other words, it was a wonderful event. And Ekha was highly qualified. Okay. Mumon's verse. Coming east, Bodhidharma, coming east, directly pointing. You entrusted the Dharma, and the trouble arose. See, trouble. I love that. See, I don't know. This is going on too long. I'll stop. But just one thing. I do think Zen is separate from politics. You know what I mean? I think you have to keep them separate. You can be very active in all kinds of things, and there's nothing wrong with social activism. I wasn't criticizing it. But what's very crucial is that we wake up on the cushion. This is very, very crucial. It's the job of Zen to wake up on the cushion. You can take that and do all kinds of things with it. But I do think what we're doing has a real-world impact. You know, I was so proud of what happened in Burma recently, because they clearly do have a tyrannical government, and it's a horrible place. But all those governments live by lies; they live on lies, and people support them because of their neurotic fears. Right? It's like it's a vicious circle, you know. The dictatorships don't come into existence by sheer force alone. They prey on people's weaknesses and desire for illusion, right? And that's how they acquire power. And this is how people get into power, is by preying on people's false hopes and fears, right? And I thought it was so powerful to see this is the power of Mu. You know, all of these monks marching through the streets, you know, they're saying, this is an illusion. This government is an illusion. This way of life is an illusion. See, the power to do that shouldn't be underestimated. Very, very important.